Yes, I've got to start with a confession, guys. So I did manage to submit two abstracts, and I promised I would confess to you for Jocelyn's sake for messing up her nice program. So this is what I'm actually going to talk about, and I'm happily answer questions on PEO as well as this. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit on protein homodimers and the idea of this allosteric signaling, which I'm going to introduce to you. And I should say also, actually, this is my first ever talk on proteins. So I'm not an expert on proteins, but I have some very good colleagues who I'd like to thank for their contributions to this project. So I'm going to describe the work of my student David Burnell and postdoc Dr. Tom Rogers, who I've learned from this conference you should describe as very talented. And I'd also like to thank my colleagues, physics, Tom McLeish. Some of the work I'm going to talk about was started off in Leeds University by Hedvika. And also, I'll mention a little bit of some biology work, some experimental work by my colleagues in biology, Martin Kahn, Philip Townsend, and M. Kapol. You'll see a little bit later on where they come into this project. So I need to sort of introduce this idea of protein allostery to you. And the idea is really simple. It's the idea that one molecule binding to a protein can have an effect on a second binding. And so the kind of picture is this: a molecule comes along, it does something to the protein, and that something it does to the protein changes a second binding. And this kind of general effect has a central role in biochemical pathways. And you can imagine different ways why that might be important. You might have a protein, an activator, and the activator does something to the protein that causes a change to the binding of protein to DNA. Or maybe as this ligand comes and binds to a protein, it enhances a second binding, which is used to regulate a process, or maybe it kind of destroys the possibilities of a second binding. And so this is a central thing to try and understand in biochemistry. And this is the conventional picture, which I'm not going to talk about. So this is normally how we would describe allostery in proteins. It's classically explained by the idea of a conformational change. So you could imagine, my pointer's about gone, so is that, I've got another pointer. Yeah, okay. So imagine that a small molecule coming along and binding to the protein. When it's bound to the protein, it's made some sort of conformational change. I've just illustrated there very simply. It might be a small conformational change, or it might be some big rearrangement of the protein. And this rearrangement then means that it's possible for this second binding to occur. So that's a conventional picture of allostery. And I'm not going to talk about that, because what I want to introduce to you is the idea of a second way in which we might have an allosteric signaling occurring. And that is that when the first molecule binds, it changes in some way the dynamics of the protein and complex. And it's that dynamical change which leads to an enhancement or a reduction in the binding of this second site here. So this idea I'm going to call a dynamic allostery, and this talk really is about trying to understand this and seeing if we can make some useful predictions about this effect. And I suppose you can think about it as a vibrational contribution to the free energy of this protein that we're going to try and influence. So here's a kind of illustration of how, yeah. What length scales? No without damping. I'm not sure I can answer that other than through the talk. Is that okay? I'll have another go at answering that a little bit later on. So let's try and illustrate the idea of a protein where this might be an important effect. So this is the catabolite gene activator protein CAP. And the movie kind of illustrates the idea that one molecule of cyclic AMP comes along and binds to one half of this protein dimer. So this protein is made of two bits, two monomers that are identical, that come together. and they're held together in the center. And then a second molecule comes along, and then this second binding is different. Now, it's a fairly small effect for CAP, but for CAP, you can measure this thermodynamically by measuring a delta-delta G. And for CAP, we have a negative cooperativity, which is defined as delta-delta G as being greater than zero. And that means that the binding for the second ligand is reduced relative to the first. Now, of course, there's a possibility that structural change could be at work here, or that one site might influence the other. But for CAP, that appears not to be the case, that these sites are quite distant. And this is a prime candidate for a molecule where we might expect to have some dynamic effect. And so I'm going to show you some work on this to try and understand it. And the aims of this talk are shown here. I want to really have two main aims to the talk. To try and show that multi or many scale models can be used to give us some insights into this. And I'm going to show you three models very briefly and some insights from them. And then secondly, I'm going to try and show you that this idea that we can understand this at simple level might give us some way of controlling the protein, so that by mutation of the protein, we can alter its function by influencing the dynamics. So that's the second key idea, really, and those are two main things. If I get time at the end, I might make some general points about how proteins work to harness dynamic pathways. So that's the plan of the talk. So I'm going to start off, really, with probably the simplest thing that you could ever do to model dynamics in a protein. So obviously, for proteins, you can look at things like normal mode analysis using an atomistic model. I'm going to do something much more simple than that. I'm going to work with a very old model that's been around for 20 years or more called the elastic network model. And the idea of this is very simple. You need to start from an experimental data, in this case, a high-resolution crystal structure of the protein. You then take the backbone there, which is illustrated here. So you've got the backbone of the protein drawn out. You can see the alpha helices and the beta sheets. And the blue dots there illustrate the C alphas in the center of each amino acid. The idea is then you define a cutoff for this model. And within that cutoff, you just connect each of these C alphas by simple Hookean springs. You can have various versions of this. The simplest model is just to have the same spring constant for each spring. And so you end up with this kind of network of springs, and you just find out the normal modes for that network of springs given by doing a normal mode analysis on this. And the thing that comes out of it, of course, is a whole set of normal modes, and it's the low-frequency modes that I'm going to suggest are important because they involve the dynamics of the whole protein. So let me just say a little bit about this and why these are believed to be quite useful. So this is just looking at the elastic network model as a function of two different cutoffs, 8 and 12 for these springs. And one of the few handles we have experimentally on protein dynamics are the B factors that we measure from X-ray. And although this is a little bit of an arbitrary scale that we're using here, you can see that from the network model, what I'm plotting here is the residues in the protein on the bottom here, and then the motion that we get over the first 25 normal modes for two different cutoffs, and you can see that these peaks actually line up reasonably well with the B factors that we get from an X-ray. Now, this will depend a little bit on cutoff. Actually, the smaller cutoffs are better, and people have looked at this, and for a molecule like CAP, about 8 Armstrong cutoff is kind of considered about the best for these elastic network models. And for that, you can get an R-squared value of about 0.8. In comparison to the B factors, which is actually a remarkably good thing to be able to do to give you some insight into why this elastic network model might say something about these vibrations. Okay, so the normal modes that you get out here illustrate some quite interesting things. Now, I just want to make two points from this slide, which shows you the first two normal modes for CAP. And the first thing to say is that the vibration you're looking at is a vibration of the whole protein. So that's the first thing to say, and that's going to be important for this talk. The second thing to say is just the structure here that's plotted out for this molecule. Now, it's a homodimer. It's made of two bits here, and the bits that joins it is this central strand here. So we've got basically two alpha helices on the monomers. The alpha helices come together like this, and they're kind of held together by very weak hydrophobic interactions. And you could immediately see, I guess, the idea that if you were to alter those hydrophobic interactions, you've got the possibility of maybe altering the dynamics of the whole thing. And you'll see that that's an important idea as we go through the talk. Okay, this is just, as you can imagine, you're going to get a whole range of frequencies, so you get a whole range of modes here. And down here at the at this end here, we've got some really low frequency things involving the whole vibration. If we were to take this up here, these are much more local, faster vibrations. If you were to do this for an atomistic model, then you can go all the way up to the hydrogens vibrating and all the rest of it. Okay. And the other thing just to mention very briefly is that this just plots the percentage collectivity against mode, and for many of these low frequency modes, that, you know, there's motion of the entire protein. This is that's a good question. It's a little bit arbitrary. It's the movement from the average structure of the whole of each residue. So we've got a kind of cutoff saying whether or not a residue is moving much or not. So it's a little bit arbitrary as that, but it just gives us an idea that in this case, say 40% of the protein is actually undergoing significant changes. Yeah, that's a better thing to say. So how could we go about thinking about allostery in terms of CAP? Well, in order to do that, we need to think about CAP and the binding with this cyclic AMP. So we've kind of got an equilibrium there. We've got CAP and two cyclic AMP models. So we've got the the biologists call ApoCAP, the bare CAP, the hollow one, and the hollow two, where you've got one and two ligands bound to it. And the simple idea with an elastic network model is that if you take your cyclic AMP and you put it into your elastic network model, you can add in some extra strings at a very simple level to take into account the fact that you've got this extra molecule in there, which is kind of bound by weak interactions to the protein. So what we'd like to do is to use that to measure something to compare with experiments. So to compare with experiment, we need to measure this binding constant. So the ratio of binding constants K2 to K1. Just to say very quickly as well that there's a kind of difference between the biologists and the chemists. The biologists actually like to quote this thing in terms of unbinding constants, whereas the chemists and I guess the physicists also like to talk about this in terms of binding constants. So when we first did this work, we got completely the opposite predictions to our biology colleagues, till we realized that they had completely the opposite way of defining things to us, and then we were happy. Okay, to do this, we're going to calculate our vibrational free energy, which can be done for this model, and then determine K2 over K1. And the first thing to say is that for CAP and this cyclic AMP, we get this same prediction that we see experimentally, that K2 over K1 is greater than 1, that we get this negative cooperativity, which corresponds to a reduced affinity. And I'm going to say a little bit more about that shortly. Okay, now the beauty of something like this elastic network model is it's relatively cheap to do. You can do it within a couple of minutes of calculation. This gives us a nice thing that one can do, and that is to look at each of these amino acids in the protein and to step through them and imagine point mutations where you change the spring constants associated with the amino acids. So this is equivalent to saying, let's change the weak hydrophobic interactions between an amino acid and its neighbors. And so we can do that because this is so quick to calculate for the entire protein, and you can look at how sensitive that might be to this delta delta G that we can calculate. So this is what I want to do, and to map it out. So I need to explain this map to you of what we're doing. So this is a map where we're going to color code this ratio of K2 over K1. The red here is going to correspond to increasing the negative cooperativity. Down here at 1 is where CAP itself lies, and this deep blue corresponds to changing from negative to positive cooperativity. So what I'm doing here is I'm plotting out a kind of two-dimensional map where I change the spring constant, and imagine for these point mutations changing the spring constant, either stiffening it up or loosening it up, and then doing that for all of the amino acids. So this is now a big calculation, because we've got to do all that machinery that we did before, but do it for every possible mutation that you could do. But as I say, because it's a quick calculation, you can do this. And you get some interesting things. You can pull out little bits of blue area and red area in our protein where we do appear to have sensitivity to this K2 over K1 by making these mutations. And this is perhaps illustrate this a little bit better. What I'm doing here is just plotting out the same kind of thing, but this time only for a decrease in the stiffness, and then color coding it onto the kind of backbone of this protein. So the red regions here corresponds to an increase in negative cooperativity. The blue regions correspond to a switch to positive cooperativity. And you can pull out some interesting generic things here. So we tend to get some red regions in this region here, where we've got these hydrophobic interactions holding together the protein dimer, the two monomers. And also, actually, interestingly, there's some blue regions kind of slightly remote from the binding site over here. This is in the DNA binding site up here, where we get the opposite effect from decreasing the stiffness. And this actually points to something nice that you might be able to do, because you might be able to point to doing some point mutations, which would allow you to change the behavior of CAP based on what we see in this really simple model. And so that's what I'm going to show you next. The idea might be, for example, that you pull out a valine amino acid residue, which is slightly hydrophobic, as you can see here, and you could mutate that to an alanine, and so you could reduce the hydrophobic interaction, or indeed you could perhaps mutate it to a leucine and you could increase the hydrophobic interaction. That on our model would give you differences, either enhancing the negative cooperativity or reducing it and perhaps pushing it down to this positive area. And as you can see from the model, that prediction would be that you would get a different change. So if we pull out something from that region where the two monomers come together, valine 132, which is kind of here on our map, you can see that the idea of mutating towards an alanine or to a leucine has opposite effects on the dynamics. So this is actually the region that we would be altering. But you can see now also that even if you're altering just here, this has an effect on the RMS variation of the protein across the whole protein. So this is actually going to affect the whole dynamics of the thing, and by that it's going to change this vibrational contribution to the binding. Okay, so what we need to do is to see if our predictions are sensible by turning to our biology colleagues. And so they're able to do something which, to a simple God-fearing chemist, is a little bit like black magic, really. They're able to do mutation of proteins by using recombinant DNA techniques. So you kind of genetically modify bugs in order to make all these protein mutations. and then you get the proteins, purify them, and then you do some calorimetry, some ITC work, in order to measure these binding constants. And so that's what we've been able to do, and I want to show you some comparisons between the predictions of the model and the experiment. So this is the prediction of the model, this is the experiment. This is the wild type. Both predict this greater than one value here corresponding to negative cooperativity. It's a little bit more an experiment than we predict for the simple model. But we can look at the mutations. So here, V132A corresponds for a valine, 132 being mutated to an alanine. We can reduce the spring constant. We can enhance the negative value of the allostery, which is seen experimentally. We can go the opposite way. We now can push it to a positive value. So we can now change CAP from being negatively cooperative to being positively cooperative. And we predict that, and we see that now in the biology. This residue here, this histidine 160, if we mutate that to a leucine, that's the residue that was far removed from the DNA binding site and the middle of the protein. It's on the edge. That's from the CAMP binding site. It's actually up near the DNA binding site. For that one, we remove a hydrogen bond in the mutation. So that's really significant slackening in the protein. And again, we get this effect predicted. For valine 140, this is more supposed to be a control thing for us here. We get this wrong, but I'll say a word about that in a minute. If we go the opposite way, then that works. This one here, 140A, was supposed to be our control residue. We actually see a significant change the opposite way experimentally. And what's happening there is actually quite interesting, because we can also do high resolution crystal structures on these experimental things. And what we see with the 140A mutation is that we actually do get a conformational change. And in that case, for the conformational change, you get a swing round of the residue. We introduce another hydrophobic interaction between valine 179. And if we put that into the model, then lo and behold, we do again predict what we see experimentally. So that's kind of nice that we can get the biology to tie in with what we've predicted. Okay, now that's all very good. It's quite a simple model. It's quite expensive in the sense that if we're going to look at whole proteins, we have to do all of these calculations. And what I wanted to say is that there's a possibility that there's some generic things there that we can pull out from what we've done. And so it would be very nice to have a super coarse grain model that would give us some understanding of generic behavior of proteins. So that's what I want to say a little bit, very briefly, about. And our reason for being optimistic about the idea of a super coarse grain model is this, really. We can make the elastic network model more coarse by getting rid of many of the springs. And many of the low frequency vibrations that you can see, you can still recover at a very simple level of a rotational translational block method, where you group bits of your protein together into blocks and then look at the vibrations of those blocks. This is a really very quick thing to be able to do. And if we do that for CAP, you do at least cover the same sorts of motions for the big motions of the whole protein that we see in an elastic network model. So that gives us a hope that we might be able to have what I'd call a super coarse grain model of CAP. And let me just explain the idea behind this. The idea is that you've kind of got a sort of scissor mode here that corresponds to this vibration of these two monomers. So this is kind of going on. And then in addition to that, we've got vibrations within the monomers themselves. So the main vibration within the monomer themselves is down here. This is the vibration, the kind of scissor mode vibration of the monomers. And then we've got a smaller motion up here at the top that corresponds to the motion of the DNA binding. So we have spring constants just to couple all this stuff together. These two aren't coupled, but this DNA binding domain's coupled to this monomer side, and then the monomers are coupled through this spring constant. So this gives you some simple spring constants that you can vary to look at the generic behavior of the protein. And there's going to be two things that are going to be really important here. One is K12 that corresponds to the coupling between the two monomers, and then this K1, which equals K2, which is the coupling within the monomers. So we can, for example, with that simple thing, again, recover normal modes out of that simple spring model. And because of that, you can plot out E delta delta G as a function of these two spring constants for the protein. And this is what I'm doing, and I'm plotting this out as a function of K12 and K1. This is where cap would sort of appear on here. And you can see that we now have, if you like, a free energy landscape that can be perturbed by altering these spring constants. And we can, for example, alter, it's particularly sensitive to K12, this hydrophobic interaction, which can push cap as being more negative up here, or we can actually reduce it down to the positive regime here. Okay, so I've only got 5 minutes left, so I just want to show you a couple of quick things before we finish. So it would be nice, seeing what we've seen in these very simple models, to see this also in atomistic simulation. But as you probably know, this is quite a difficult thing to do, because protein dynamics are quite slow on the scale of atomistic simulations. But we would like to try and see this if we can. So we can at least in Durham run up to about 200 nanoseconds or so on the machines that we've got. And so we're going to do a fully atomistic simulation using AMBER, 2 femtosecond time step of the whole protein in water with the cyclic AMP and all the rest of it, using the usual AMBER force field and our usual terms for doing that. So it's a big simulation. This is going to have about 10,000 odd water molecules, 401 amino acids for the full protein. And what you can do, of course, for the atomistic simulations, you do a principal component analysis, pull out the key dynamical modes from the motion of the protein, measured relative to the average structure. So, just a word to say about this is that you do need really long simulations to do this. So these results only converge when you get up to past 150 nanoseconds. So you really do need things run over a very long time to start to see this. So we'd like to see what comes out of this. I'll just say very briefly as well that actually this principal component analysis, the frequencies and the motion that you get actually agrees with what we see in the elastic network model and also a normal mode analysis too. So that's good. But the cute thing about the PCA is that you actually do see this change in dynamics for different eigenvectors. So I'm plotting here the motion in eigenvector 1 and 2 and in 3 and 4. This is for the APO camp. This is for the HOLO 1 camp. So this is the change that happens when you bind your cyclic AMP. So this is actually changing the motion in this eigenvector compared to here. So we're seeing a change in the dynamics of the whole thing and seeing that in the atomistic simulation. You get far less of a change down here when you bind a second cyclic AMP, and of course that's part of the loosening and maybe slight tightening effect that we see that we predict with the elastic network model. Okay, some final ideas. So I want to say that I think this allosteric binding that we see, this dynamic effect, can be looked at different levels, and there's some insight to be seen from the models we've shown you. We've actually also, although we haven't got the experimental work to back us up, we've also done this for a couple of other proteins, for LACR and GLXR, which actually show even larger effects than CAP. There's also some other things that would be really nice to do. So, for example, you might imagine that there could be things like dynamic contributions to the binding of DNA to proteins. That might be interesting because that might be involved in some of the sequence-specific things that we can't see in X-ray structures. So there might be a dynamic contribution there. We don't know that, but this is one idea behind this. And then finally, if I've just got a couple of minutes to finish off, 2 minutes, okay. Finally, just as I want to show you that dynamics are actually important in all sorts of things. I'll just show you one very simple example of this. This is Conexin. Conexin 26 is what we call a gap junction protein. So this will actually bridge between two membranes. And the idea of this is that you've got two blocks of protein here. And that each of these blocks are made up of six proteins. And what happens here is that CO2 comes and binds to this, and when it binds to this, this alters the properties of this funnel pore that we have. And so you can see here where the CO2 binding site's here. And this sort of thing we can also look at with things like our elastic network model ideas. And so here's what the elastic network model for Connexin would look like. You can see we've put in again our 8 angstrom cutoff. The red here would be where we put in CO2s to make the change for the elastic network model to take into account the binding. And I'll just show you 2 slides to show you the results of that. So this is no CO2 here, this is CO2 here, this is the main mode, and you can see a radical change in the motion that you get in that because of the change that we've implemented because of the change in stiffness with the CO2. And you can see a little movie of this. So this is just the motion in the main mode, and you can see very clearly now that when you move from no CO2 to CO2, it changes the vibrations, and this pore will no longer close up in the presence of CO2. This channel never closes. So you can see that there's actually other areas where this dynamics is really important, and it would be lovely to get some insights over these long time scales. Okay, so this is my summary slide, just to summarize what we've seen. So I've tried to show you that these calculations point to an interesting phenomenon which I'm going to call dynamic allostry. The thermodynamic basis for this is our vibrational contribution to delta delta G, and we've shown you some insights from simulations at different levels which give you an idea of how this might work. The key idea that we introduced was the idea that third site mutation provides a possible mechanism to control this dynamic allostry, and perhaps as well there's this nice potential for many interesting insights that you can get from looking at dynamics, not just the static picture for what's happening in terms of proteins. And I'll just finish by thanking again my collaborators to this project, and thanking you for your attention.
Before I pass it out, one quick question.
Yes.
Are the spin constants all the same, or they can...
Yeah, the spin constants are all the same in our simple models. I didn't tell you about this, but actually we've done a huge array of these different models. So as you probably know, there's all sorts of different elastic network models, Gaussian network models, ones where you can change the spring constant for different amino acids. We've also done normal mode analysis and all the rest of them. We've done them all, and we do get similar effects to what I've just shown you in the simple model. If you make the models a little bit more sophisticated, going all the way up to normal mode analysis atomistically, then you actually seem to recover a little bit more of a free energy change. And the simpler you make the models, going down to the RTB model, you actually lose some of that change. So that's the effect of making the models more sophisticated. So it's like you kind of coupling in some of the higher frequency modes into the effect. I'm not sure I quite understand that. Tom Cleish has a kind of theory that they've written up in biochemical journal, biophysical journal, to kind of explain that. It's enslaving of modes.
Other questions?
Okay, so I can now ask my question again.
Yes,
so I have nothing against normal mode analysis. My question is basically whether it's mass times acceleration equals those force, elastic forces, or is it friction times friction times velocity? Because my naive expectation would be on the for the low frequency mode or long wavelength modes, that dissipation would be much more dominant than acceleration, and you will be overdamped, and so it will not be a vibration mode at all. There would be other modes. It would be basically relaxational modes, diffusive type modes, not vibrational modes. So since you do the atomistic simulations, you should easily see whether you are in a underdamped, overdamped for your low frequency modes.
Yeah, okay. So
With water on those scales, there is no way inertia would be important.
Yeah, okay, so just to say very briefly, because we've done the atomistic simulations, It does allow us to be able to see a similar effect that we're seeing from the normal mode analysis.
Right.
So, what you see is, yes, you do get things that look just like the normal modes in terms of the behavior that of the motion of the protein, that they are damped, as you would expect, by the presence of water and all the rest of it. So you see that from the atomistic simulation, but the point is you still see things that look almost the same as both the normal modes we see from atomistic normal mode analysis and what we see from normal mode analysis of the elastic network model. There's still the same global motions of the protein. So we're confident that even though you get this damping and all the rest of it from the presence of water, that the kind of generic effect of vibrations being important is still there.
So can I repeat it again? The normal mode analysis, which is analysis of the matrix of your little springs, is no problem because that's the fourth side of your equation.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the other sides of the equation, which could be mass times acceleration or friction times velocity. And since you're overdamped, you're actually your effect you're talking about changing the structure of modes should still be tried, but the motion is not vibrational. The motion is diffusive. So your conclusions are still valid, but they should be interpreted differently.
Okay.
It's not you're not affecting vibration of your proteins. You're affecting the way protein diffuses under the thermal motion of water. And it's not vibration.
Okay.
Yeah, just to maybe add on to that, then the friction coefficient would presumably be length scale dependent as well. So the largest modes that you find are the most damped, probably.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't see as much of them as you expect to, or based on this analysis. But I had another question actually about spring constants again. So are the actual spring constants identical or the spring moduli? In other words, does a shorter spring have the same spring constant as a longer spring?
No, it's in the simplest elastic network model, the spring constant is the same for everything. But there's lots of variations of elastic network models where you can make it more sophisticated if you want to. So you can make the spring constant larger for shorter contacts if you want to. Or you can change it for amino acids.
Yeah.
You can sort of increase it for particular amino acids. And we've played with that, and we do get similar effects that we see here. The reason why we didn't want to go too much down that line is that we kind of wanted to have a model that you could just throw at a protein without needing to look individually at what you need to alter. So with something like this, you can just throw that model at the protein. You just take the crystal structure that you get, the high resolution crystal structure from the PDB, and it's a generic model that you apply to the protein, and then it gives you a nice prediction about what's happening.
I understand. So in that generic model, what sets the scale for the spring constant, or it doesn't matter?
Well, it doesn't matter in the case of allostree because it disappears out. So it's an arbitrary setting. If you want it to then try and make a prediction for the magnitude of the effect, then you'd want to try and correlate the frequencies to say an atomistic model or something.
Right. So if I wanted to use like one of these models to estimate the rigidity of an entire protein, if I push on it, then I clearly would need to set some scales. Would I need to compare that to experiments and tune it that way, or is there an independent way of determining that?
You could tune it to experiment. You can, clearly these days, protein vibrations, you can pick up signals from these things, I think, even possibly in terahertz spectroscopy. So that would be possibly one experimental thing to do. You can also do things like this fluorescent labeling, things that give you an idea of motion. I'm not sure that gives you the
but there's not some knowledge-based lookup table for sensitive
yeah,
value.
Yeah, there may be. There may be for that. Yeah, I mean, normally the thing to do would be that if you have, if you want it to compare it, say, to atomistic simulation, so you can do an atomistic normal mode analysis, it will take a little bit longer, and you can make a link to the scale there. The thing you can't easily do with the atomistic normal mode analysis is start going around doing all of this mutation, because it's pretty hard to do atomistic normal mode analysis. You need within a force field to minimize the energy to a high level of convergence, and only then can you do the normal mode analysis, and that's actually quite a big job in itself. And so you can't do all the point mutation stuff that I showed you.
Okay, thank you.
I'm kind of confused by your discussion with Michael, which was kind of technical at the end. My question is, taking your model or your view you now have, what is really relevant for the effect you see? Is it the oscillation of your object, or is this a conformational fluctuation? My impression was that it was a conformational fluctuation and not so much the oscillation.
Well, I think it's... I tried to argue... So Michael's perhaps not going to agree with me. I tried to argue that it's the vibrational contribution to the free energy. So imagine taking a cyclic AMP molecule, binding it to your protein, and the atomistic simulation has shown this kind of loosening up effect. The protein.
Yeah, but the point is, does it have to be this regular oscillation, or is it enough that you have fluctuation
reduced by the
environment?
I think it's enough that you loosen it up, because when you then go and bind a second molecule, then that's now going to be bound to something which, if you like, is looser, and so that's where the free energy, the delta delta G, comes from. So that's my view of what the main origin of the effect is.
So it's stochastic in the end.
Sorry?
It's stochastic in the end within a potential.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, okay.
I think actually I'm confused by the distinction as well. The first mechanism, when the first ligand binds, there's an overall conformational change of the protein. And one gap opened up, remember? When one thing bound, the gap where the other one's going to go, what increased or decreased in size, and that aided the...
No, that was my very first picture showed,
right.
And that's the usual view,
right,
of Alastair. And I'm saying that for things like CAP, that doesn't happen.
The evidence
we have are things like the X-ray.
I agree, but the point is, in that kind of mechanism, what happens is that there is a struggle on binding the first object. There is a change in the structure of the protein. And what that does is change not only the location of the minima of all the vibrational modes, it changes the frequencies as well. So that mechanism involves a significant change in general in the vibrational characteristics of the molecule, including a frequency change and including a change in the zero of the vibrational energy.
Yep.
So in some sense, vibration is an important feature of the first mechanism.
I totally agree with that, but it's completely ignored normally.
No, in the second
so people just like to look at these static pictures.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
But in the second mechanism, it seems like the distinction is one in which you bind, and you're going to presumably the only thing you can do that's thermodynamically significant is change the frequencies or the zeros the frequencies or the energies at the minima of the vibrational modes.
Yeah.
As long as you don't change the location of those minima, then you say you don't have any conformational change. But you certainly, the features that you're seeing are presumably related to a change in the location of the minima of the vibrationals. I'm sorry, the energies at the minima and the frequencies, because that's all you can do.
Yeah, that's right, I think.
Okay, but the point is, those changes are an intrinsic part of this first mechanism, which you've rejected as well. So it looks like all of the mechanisms have that effect in it, would be my guess.
I don't disagree with what you're saying. I'm sure that's also part of the first mechanism, but it's not something that's normally considered. And what I suppose I wanted to show with these simple ideas was that, you know, this idea of this dynamic contribution is sufficiently important that there is a kind of control space that you have for the dynamics. So in one sense, you can't just say that proteins have kind of evolved to make structural changes that will have an effect. You could also maybe say that proteins have evolved to have a situation where the dynamics will change things as well.
I think there's something spurious about using dynamics in this way to discuss what are basically equilibrium thermodynamic or equilibrium statistical mechanical problems. It's just anything that has to do with binding, with a binding constant, with a free energy, a delta G. You should be able to express that entirely in terms of, or understand that entirely in terms of equilibrium distribution functions and equilibrium probabilities. And how the things move around is really irrelevant once you've specified those static thermal distributions for any thermodynamic property at all.
Okay, I'm not sure I quite agree with you, but. Yes, sir.
So we've played with similar models for virus capsids, and the local modulus seems to be very sensitive to the coordination number, because in many cases you're sort of near the percolation point of rigidity. And I was just wondering whether you've looked at the number of springs to some of these points where you've made mutations, and whether there's a correlation between coordination number and the sensitivity to changes in mutation.
We've not looked in detail at this. We looked at the different cutoffs as one way of looking at that. And certainly this A time strongs that people use a lot, that actually gives us the best correlation to the B factors and probably also gives us the best results in terms of the allostery. So, I mean, that's all we've done on that.
One last question. So to try to get some consensus between the audience and the speaker, if I have a harmonic system and I overdamp it, the vibrational entropy doesn't change, right? So I can do a normal mode analysis and I can calculate the vibrational entropy the same way, whether it's overdamped or underdamped. And so I think your whole way of computing vibrational entropy is perfectly valid, whether it's overdamped or underdamped. And if you only ever use the entropy to do calculate your allosteric effects, the fact that it's overdamped or underdamped is irrelevant, right? You just have a diffusive mode versus a vibrational mode. So maybe it's just a nomenclature issue. Maybe we should call it entropic allostery or something like that.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's a good comment. Thanks.
All right, one announcement before we break. Please go to the conference desk and let them know if you have any transportation needs. For those who are, don't have their own transportation, and do that during the break so they know how to coordinate the van, etc. And if that, let's thank both speakers again.